Good evening. At this time, Mel and Dick begin the TechNet. For those who haven't heard the TechNet before, its major purpose is education about all these many facets of a hobby called ham radio. And there's 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio, all related by wireless technology, with some computers added in. Hopefully Paul will be with us tonight, WS2N, to give us some more information about what's going on with NASA. They've had a pretty rough week with three separate scandals all revealed, re-revealed this particular week. Other than that, I bet you Mel's got a couple of emails that he's received, and we'll try to cover those. And 6 meters has been doing some good things. We may be hearing about that. So as the way a person signs into the TechNet is to give Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and you follow that with a yes, and the yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
This is KC2QYW. The name is Joe, and no question at this time.
WA2KXE, Art, yes.
And WS2N, Paul, with the space report. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
Okay, so far we've got Mel, Joe. We've got Mel, Joe, and Art. Who did we skip so far?
WS2N, Paul, with the space report.
We got you, Paul. So when it comes to check-ins, we've got Joe and Art. Anyone else? Of the people with questions or non-questions, we have Joe and Art. We also have Mel and Paul. Anyone else check-in? Give me a call at this time. Okay, let's start off with Art. Art, take your time. You're the only one right now. WA2, Kilo X-Ray Charlie, if I get you right. Art, K2RIW. My name is Dick. Go right ahead.
Good evening, Dick, and good evening, Mel. No, it's Kilo X-Ray Echo. Art, you call me, sent you an email back in the olden days when I was the president of Limark. And good evening to you, Mel. Mel, your call rings a bell also. I think I ran across your QSL talk from a 2-meter AMQ, so 30-odd years ago. Anyway, the question I have, Dick, actually, it's being related upon from a good friend of mine and an old ATD buddy of yours, Alan, K2RYT. I was on the phone with him today, and basically, he's got an interest in a FM radio station out in eastern Long Island, which is on 92.1 megahertz, and he was always hearing that station out in his neck of the woods, let's put it, Babylon Township. He told me lately he's been hearing at his house, in Mobile, his car, or any of the fire vehicles he's in, he hears what it sounds like white noise right on that frequency in that whole general area. Now, I'm not that up to snuff with the BPL situation, but my thought was possibly could this be something in the form of a BPL or testing in that area? You know, lots of times you hear about the military installations giving interference on UHF, but I don't really think that's the case. So you're basically talking here on a 92 megahertz signal, which, you know, there may be a harmonic or subharmonic involved also. Go ahead, Dick.
My first guess, Art, is this could be a simple front-end overload. The radio receiver that's in my Toyota automobile, Toyota Camry, 1999, when I drive near exit 52, I think it is, the local radio station there overloads a number of stations. So there's a couple of stations I can tune to out here. Other stations, I just hear white noise. Everything just gets blanked out while I'm within about a quarter of a mile of that particular radio station. So the way receivers are designed these days with synthesized local oscillators and quite often a non-tracking front end, they don't have a lot of RF selectivity, so that when something is strong enough to create strong overload of the first couple of stages of the radio, the radio essentially goes dead. If you were doing a laboratory test of this phenomenon, you would call it blocking dynamic range. In other words, what's the weakest signal you can receive? What's the strongest signal that could be one, two, or three channels away, and still you're listening to a weak signal, and the weak signal is only degraded by, let's say, 3 dB. And so the difference between the weakest signal and the strongest signal three channels away, if that was like 80 dB of amplitude difference, that would be 80 decibels of blocking dynamic range. Because of the so-called inverse square law, when you're close to a strong radio station, front-end overload is very easily occurring. Another time it used to happen to me is when I would drive by Sunnyside Boulevard. If I was listening to a strong station like Limox, the one you're listening to right now, and if my preamplifier was turned on, an AR squared preamplifier, as I drove by Sunnyside Boulevard with an extremely tall 300-foot tower, Elliot Gross's tower to be exact, which used to have a lot of paging transmitters and what on there, I would not be able to hear Limox with the preamp turned on. Turn off the preamp, and Limox came through reasonably well. That was the kind of front-end overload, blocking dynamic range. So that, in my opinion, is more likely than some of the other alternatives you've offered there, Art. And now, pinning it down, I guess there are various ways by way of a website, a search, and so on, that you could find out what stations are in the area that are capable of giving a strong signal within a reasonable frequency region. If you're listening to a 2-meter radio station, anything from FM broadcast all the way up to, 150-megacycle commercial stations are capable of giving you overload. I know of a fire department on Long Island in the Islip area, which is experiencing some overload from extremely strong local signals until a super filter was put in the front end. It was having a fair amount of grief. So once you find out the source, solving it is the next step. You're going to be asking questions about that. But let's make sure that I haven't misunderstood your question so far, Art. WA2 Kilo X-ray Echo. Sorry, I got your call letters wrong. K2RIW at the TechNet.
Okay, very good. K2RIW, WA2KX. You know, you pretty much had the question correct. Maybe I got to give a little more clarification. He has always heard this radio station at his house, no matter where he went, no matter what vehicle he was in. Given this good propagation, he would hear this radio station. The station he went to listen to transmits out of Sag Harbor, and he's having this interference problem in the Babylon area. So unless there's some kind of a new broadcasting station in that general frequency range, which I'm sure you would have known about, it's probably not going to be a broadcast station. And something's been, he's always heard it. I was over here where I am in Merrick. I do not have the problem. So it just seems to be something local in that area there. And with a wide variety of receivers he was talking about, you're talking about he's got an exceptional receiver with a Yagi tune for 92.1 megahertz pointed out east. He's got radios he's listened to in a fire department ambulance and whatnot, so he's had that problem. So maybe might just pay do a little more investigation. Maybe we can find out where it's a little stronger than other areas. But my first thought was maybe this interference that might be testing from LIPA. That was just my first thought. Go ahead.
That's sort of unlikely. The LIPR interference, if you heard it, which is called broadband over power line, BPL, really is digital in nature. It'll have some clicks and pops and bursts to it. Each individual transmission is kind of brief. So it's got a characteristic sound. And the fact that you're hearing a broadcast radio station and can recognize the music, the announcing, and whatever, tells me there's more of a steady-state phenomenon. Now, Alan, when I first was mildly introduced to amateur television around 1971 or so, Alan, living in Amityville, used to put on his camera on his shoulder and go walking around the house and into the backyard with a very long cable, and it was being transmitted from his Amityville house to my Huntington House, and I was literally living his life. I was looking at my television screen, hearing his audio, and seeing what his eyes were seeing as he walked around the house, introduced me to his pets, his kitchen, his backyard. He'd go into the backyard and aim the camera up in the air, and I would see the tower that's sending me the signal. It was fascinating stuff. He would also, during the time there were floods in Amityville, and he would make a video recording of people paddling in their rowboats up and down the center of the street where he lived, and he would have a little bit of music playing in the background. This is on 439 megacycles, and so it's a wide open frequency range. In the background, you do a little bit of Surfing USA as people are paddling up and down the street where they live. A fascinating character. My strongest recommendation is that you beg, borrow, steal, or whatever, something like a spectrum analyzer. With a spectrum analyzer connected to whatever antenna you normally use, and you scan across the frequency range, it'll become extremely obvious real fast what's the strong blip on the screen, and you zero in on that and find out who he is and what frequency he's on. The next step below that would be to use some kind of a scanner that scans across all possible frequencies. There are various kinds of scanners that will scan from the DC to light, so to speak, and it will stop on every strong signal they find. You can set the squelch on these machines so that it only stops on signals that are 10 dB above the noise, 20 dB above the noise, 30 dB above the noise. You can put it in front-end pads so that only the strong signals get through the padding and get above threshold of the receiver. So by way of a scanner or a spectrum analyzer, scanning across the frequency range when connected to the antenna that has the offending signal, you will very rapidly find out who the strong guy is. Also, by finding out that is it there only some of the time, like when the brief transmissions are made for two-way radio, or is it there 24 hours a day? 24 hours a day strongly suggests that it's broadcast or some kind of a beaconing signal. There are cell phone sites, for instance, that transmit a continuous beacon tone, which aligns frequencies and data clock rates and things like this. So there are a number of signals that are there 24 hours a day. By way of spectrum analyzer or scanner, you'll find out what frequency it is. Once you know what frequency it is, then there are ways you can put in a simple T connector and a coaxial stub tuner, shorted or open, with or without tuner on the stub, and so you can suck out a particular frequency that's offending you. There are ways you can do it with the antenna. You can create a null in that direction. In the frequency domain, you can use simple filters like inductors and capacitors. I would start off with a stub filter first, and if that's not doing it, then you have to get more elaborate with a multi-stage filter. But you talk to the people who have ever worked with television interference, radio interference, telephone interference, I can assure you that every single interference issue is solvable. There are many people who say, gee, that signal is so strong, I'm never going to be able to live with it. Well, with the right kind of filtering, the right kind of shielding, the right kind of antenna aiming, the right kind of dynamic range of the receivers in use and so on, once you identify who it is, how strong they are, it's just a matter of applying the right techniques that are well known. Every single interference or undesired signal reception is solvable, and there's essentially no exception to that. The strongest example I can think of is where NASA transmits the signals to their remote vehicles out in space. You take, for instance, a Voyager that's now beyond Pluto by a whole long distance. They transmit a 10,000-watt signal to Voyager. They get back a signal that is, let me think now, around minus 140 dBm. And a 10,000-watt is 2,000 watts plus 60, 10,000 is 70. There's the antenna gain, about 100, 110. So we're talking about 240 decibels of difference in signal strength between what they transmit and what they receive. And there's only a small percentage of frequency difference between the transmit signal and the receive signal when they're talking to Voyager. Is that an interference problem? Can you imagine having a 10,000-watt transmitter with about a 50 decibels gain antenna, and the transmitting horn and the receiving horn are co-located? They're both focused into the exact same parabolic dish antenna that's aimed at the Voyager spacecraft, which is, you know, way beyond Pluto when they're talking to it. In that particular case, the difference in signal level is so great that the slightest
micro-ohm of difference between the resistance of two adjacent metallic panels that are on the reflector of that antenna, and whether or not every one of the rivets makes good contact. As the wind blows and the dish shakes, that little bit of shaking can create a micro-ohm of difference between those two plates, and that makes an amount of interference that makes a scratching noise in the receiver. And the receiver is taught how to tune that out, so to speak, when it comes to the digital signal processing. So there's an example of extreme blocking dynamic range requirement, and it was solved. Yes, it takes some pretty heroic equipment to do it. So I know Alan has got the resources. Once he gets the right raw information as to who's doing it. On a quick break, when it comes back to you, Art, I mean, take your time. When it comes back to you, the interference that he hears is 92.1. I presume he's hearing it on everything in the house 24 hours a day. I'm guessing he's very near that station. He probably can easily find out how many miles it is from his house. And if it's a fraction of a mile away, it's going to take some heroic efforts to make sure it's not coming through everything. K2KXC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
November 2, Oscar Alpha Mike.
Okay, N2 OAM recognized. Okay, thank you for all the information, Dick. I'll relay it to Al. As I said, the station he's listening for, the actual station that he wants to hear is out in Sag Harbor, which is eastern Long Island, and it has its interference in the Babylon area. I thought of something also, but it's probably going to be way off. There is a television translator station works at in Amityville. I see it's, I believe it's in the channel 55, I think it is. Long Island station. I believe they have a translator in the Amityville area. But I don't know what channel it's on, what frequency, but I just thought about that. All right. I have enough information to go back to Alan and let him know where to start. And I'm assuming everything's 24 hours a day. He did not give me any indication that it was intermittent or sporadic. And I didn't ask him if it was on any other stations, because for the most part, he doesn't care about any of the other stations, any of the other FM stations. But I have enough information, and I'll go back to him, and with your regards, maybe he'll be able to solve the problem. I'm sure he will. K2RIW, and you have the station just checked in. It was N2OAM. This is WA2KX.
Yeah, have Alan come to the TechNet and check in once in a while. Come back with any news you've got, Art, whether it's successful or unsuccessful. We'd all like to hear the further episodes of this particular incident. And to Oscar Alpha Mike, go right ahead, Bob. What would you like to add to all this? Or you have a question. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Yes, good afternoon. Good evening, Dick, and everybody on the net. I can add a little bit of info to this current subject. I'm a friend of Al's. I used to work for him when he was chief engineer at WGBB back a long time. And I was visiting him, I guess it was about 2 months ago. And at that particular time, WLNG was absolutely full quiet in his house, not even a hint of this. So whatever this problem is, it just popped up in the last 2 months. So you might want to maybe check recent licensees or new licensees in that area. That might be one way to track it. Just thought I'd drop in and say that. Thanks a lot, and appreciate the mess. Thank you, OAM.
WS2N, question on the topic.
All recognized. Thank you, Bob. And do convince Al to join us. TechNet's been around for 25 years. Let me think now. Al and I used to have these television QSOs. I call them television QSOs because I never really transmitted very much television from my house. It was all one way, unfortunately. He supplied the signal to me, and I told him how beautiful it was while I'm looking at it on my screen and taking a Polaroid pictures off the screen of what he was doing. It looked like fun stuff. And I was getting heavily interested in the 432. So that was roughly 1971, 72 time frame. That makes it, what, 35 years ago. Whoa. A lot of water under the bridge since then. And I'd like to talk to Al. He's an old buddy from way back. Paul, go ahead with your question or comment. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, I put 92.1 FM on my little transistor radio in a house, which is a telescopic whip, and I'm going to get, I would call it deadpool quieting, it's quite clear, but am I getting another station that they're not listening to? Is this supposed to be jazz? Because that's type of music that's on there now. They didn't identify, so just wondering if that's what we're listening for. I didn't get their call letters, so is that the type of music there?
I'm not sure that the Art knows. Art, do you happen to know what kind of a station Al's listening to? And what, in other words, what kind of material he hears?
It's QSL. WLNG transmits oldies. And they may have thrown in a jazz station now and then. As a matter of fact, there was a station that was on frequency for a while that I used to hear, which somebody may have intimated might have been a pirate, which was all in Hebrew. And I did not hear any ID when I listened to it. I listened, you know, 3 minutes before, 3 minutes after, as per the FCC regulation. And into OAMs, good evening to him. I also worked with Al. I worked with him from 1975 to 1977. I believe he must have been there before then. So that's the genre, I believe they call it, is oldies. And I could always go online and see what they're playing, but that's basically it. It's oldies, and, you know, he does do a show at that station at night, and wants to listen to it out here, and all he hears is this white noise, which he thought might have been that Hebrew station that somebody was doing some kind of, I don't know, pirating with, but I don't know, but I'm sure he'll figure it out.
Yeah, there are very few kinds of interference that are transmitted 24 hours a day that would give you white noise. Most of the digital-like signals have got a bursting nature to it and a very characteristic raspy sound of the actual digital bits and of information, whereas standard broadcast does have a very steady carrier to it, particularly FM, FM or AM is a very steady carrier. So, but he's hearing it 24 hours a day, to the best of our knowledge. Quite possibly, maybe they've recently changed the antenna pattern, power output, or whatever. And as I said, I've now had two separate automobiles, a Honda and a Toyota. Both had the exact same problem when I tried by the exact same station near Crooked Hill Road on the Long Island Expressway, east of Exit 51, but before Exit 53. As I go by there, half of my dial, my FM dial, goes blank, maybe one-third. So certain stations I can listen to, and certain stations I cannot listen to. If I'm listening to the NPR station in New York City as I drive by there, I get either white noise or nothing, completely blank, because of simple front-end overload. And in fact, it's interesting sometimes, if I'm in the passing lane of the expressway and a very large tractor-trailer truck is on the next lane to the right of me, and the broadcast station near Crooked Hill Road is south of the expressway, because of the blockage of the tractor trailer, sometimes I can hear the NPR station from New York City while I'm passing in that area. So I literally, if I don't want to tune somewhere else during that period of time, which is about a 1 mile stretch. So I've seen things like this, and it's very popular with modern day equipment. In the old days, you had a radio with a dial with dial cord, and you're changing a pair of 365 picofarad air variable capacitors. One was moving the local oscillator, one was moving the RF front end, and so in fact there's usually a triple gain. Two of those capacitors were the input and output tuning of the RF front end, and one of them was the local oscillator. And with all of that tuning and tracking, front end overload was nowhere near as much of a problem. Now with modern day equipment where everything is synthesized, quite often the equipment, they don't bother worrying about the tracking front end. The good news is the equipment is simpler. The bad news is it has a much smaller blocking dynamic range. The average user of the automobile doesn't dwell in any one spot long enough to consider it too much of an annoyance. They don't have the right vocabulary to know how to complain about it. So since no one's complaining, they're not voting with their pocketbook, if you know what I mean, therefore the manufacturer can keep making the radios in a way that's less expensive, and we the consuming public, keep buying them because we don't yet have enough communication among ourselves to identify the problem to know what to complain about. If you can't put the problem in the right vocabulary, it's very hard to complain to the guy that's selling you the piece of equipment that what you don't like and what you want to improve and why you're going to buy brand A versus brand B and whether or not you can go to the consumer's report and find out which radios do and don't have this problem. It hasn't been identified. And it's a crying shame. It's one of a number of problems like that. Anyway, with any further comments on all of the above, give me a call with us right now, KQRAW in the ZECNAT. Anyone else to check in? Because we've had John, who said Joe, who said he doesn't have a question. Art, who certainly has a darn good question. Bob has already given us some, Bob and Paul has given us some information. Anyone else with further information or would like to check into the ZECNAT, give me a call with us right now.
KC2BCI.
KC2BCI, Baker Charlie, India. Start off with your name, sir, and go right ahead with your question or comment.
My name is Zeddy, KC2BZI, Kilo Charlie 2, Bravo Zulu, India. Yeah, our comment is a radio that has poor performance. It receives very poorly. A lot of people like to modify them and get the extra bling out of it. And a lot of people like to do that. Or buy some preamplifiers. That's my comment. Thank you, Dick. Over.
Very fine, Eddie. When it comes to a radio of poor performance, the word poor is a very relative word. Almost every one of us in the 1985 time frame would say that the currently manufactured Motorola handy-talkie that's used by zillions of police departments, and you could drop it on the ground, you could drop it from a two-story building onto asphalt, and it would probably survive. It damaged the battery, but the radio would survive. It was a tough, highly popular radio, selling for quite a few thousand dollars. It had all the appearance of quality. As such, NASA, in the case of astronaut Owen Garriott, on space shuttle number 65, I think it was, I'm not sure which space shuttle it was, but the 1985 space shuttle, he flew in space with that Motorola radio connected to an antenna that was taped to the upper observation window of the space shuttle. While he's flying over the United States, zillions of ham radio operators were shouting to him. And that poor radio wasn't designed for that environment. It was overloaded like crazy, and there were times when it presented nothing but white noise because there were so many strong signals coming into it at the same time. There are radios that could be designed for that environment that would survive it. That exact same radio, by the way, you go to the observation deck of the Empire State Building, you've got a whole lot of local, strong television and radio broadcast signals, only a small number of feet away from you. That radio will behave in ways that are very, very different than when you're using it at your QTH or from your automobile. So there are quality pieces of equipment, expensive, well-designed, rugged, which are not designed for that environment, that will give you a poor response. You can take any handy talkie you own, running on the rubber duck, walking around your house, 99% of the time you're happy with the performance. Connect that handy talkie to a real good base station antenna that's got some real good altitude, and now the handy talkie is getting some very strong signal. I guarantee it's going to behave in ways you don't like. I don't care if it's any one of the major brands, Kenwood, Icom, Yaesu, or any other brand of handy-talkie, very few of them. If you happen to live near a standard broadcast station, if you happen to live near police, fire, taxi cab dispatching, oil company, whatever, if you live near any kind of a strong station within a fraction of a mile of your house, which is going to be getting a gangbuster signal into the antenna that's at your base station, and with the BNC connecting, you connect that antenna to your handy-talkie, guarantee that some of the signals you want to listen to are not going to be there. So it's a very relative thing. It takes very specific design. In the case of a handy-talkie, you're between a rock and a hard place. The whole idea of a handy-talkie is that when it's in the standby mode, when a signal is not being received and squelched, or if it's in the sleeper mode, you want it to draw a very little current so that it doesn't drain the battery real fast. You'd like the battery to run for 24 hours between charges, at least, if you could get it. And As such, you want low current train. If you want a radio with high dynamic range, you must put a lot of current into the earlier stages. You can't get dynamic range without putting current into a stage. A stage that is current starved will be, by definition, lower in third order intercept point. That's a way of describing mathematically the dynamic range of the front end of your radio. So, a handy talkie that's conservative on the battery but has high dynamic range is a little bit similar to, as I've said before, asking for a human being that looks like Raquel Welch but has the brain of Einstein. You don't get that combination. You don't get that combination with a handy talkie. Low current drain, high dynamic range. There's some really good base station radios. One of my favorites is the Kenwood TS-711. It's got a front end that's reasonably bulletproof, but it's a fairly big base station radio that draws some current, and it runs from the 110-volt line. There was a Yaesu rig, the VC-221R, I think it was, popular in the mid-80s. It also had a tracking front end and was very, very bulletproof. There are lots of other kinds of rigs that we all get a hold of these days. In the case of 2-meter reception and 440 reception, most of them are very easy to overload. The early transistor radios that worked on 80 through 10 meters, your HF rigs, had a lot of this problem in the beginning. And the ham radio operators would compare the performance of their tube rig to a solid-state rig, and an awful lot of them said, I'm not going to use solid-state. And the manufacturers recognized that real fast and did something about it when it comes to base station 80 through 10 meter rigs. But we amateurs haven't done enough complaining when it comes to 6.2 and 432 rigs. 440 rigs. We haven't done enough of that complaining about overload, and the VHF rig in some cases are pretty bad on that one. An ICOM 741, I think it was, 745, 741, one of those ICOMs, a number of guys tried to use them during a contest operation on 2 meters and 440, and they still recognized the fact that overload was a serious problem. You talk to the guys who do an extremely good operation. Trying to think of the name of the guys now that go to Mount Tom, Massachusetts, W1. What's the name of that particular group? Somebody break in if you can tell me. Okay, that particular group, year after year, gets an extremely high score in the VHF contest of June and September. And as such, they do a real good study of which rigs should be used, what filters should be put in front of them, what receiver filtering, and what shielding is required, where you place each of the antennas so that the individual operations can all run simultaneously on all of those VHF bands without interfering with each other. And it takes some design study. It requires some hardware. It requires diligence to make it happen. It doesn't happen automatically. But they again, are a example of the fact that almost every electromagnetic interference or electromagnetic compatibility problem is solving. When you've got a kilowatt rig on every single VHF band from 6 meters to 1296 and high power rigs on even the bands above that, and they're all running simultaneously and they're all within roughly 100 feet of each other, they're all connected to antennas that are on the same tower, you've got to do some pretty careful design to make sure that when the guy on 6 or 2 meters transmits, that the guy isn't going to be blocked on 432 or 440 at the same time, or 1296, particularly when there's harmonic relationships between those bands. A guy on 144 megs transmitting Morse code, 144.1, the third harmonic of that falls at 432.3, and he's going to be giving you interference if you haven't done some careful filtering. Every one of these problems is solvable. K2RIW, TechNet. We're listening. Anyone else would like to check in or make some comments? Give me a call in the name right now. Okay. Paul, let's go over to the space portion of our space report. We missed you last week, and that's perfectly right. This week, you've probably seen a number of news reports that NASA is now living under three, not count them three, simultaneous embarrassing situations. Number one is a report that astronauts have been taking off that are slightly intoxicated or were doing some heavy consumption of alcohol a small number of hours before taking off. Number two, there is an apparent sabotage that took place on the computer that was going to be launched on the International Space Station on the very next mission. Not a vital computer. I was monitoring them, loading on the arms that I think hold the solar cells, but apparently the vendor, which is not a Florida vendor, discovered that someone had intentionally cut some wires behind a panel of that particular computer and would have made it reasonably useless had it not been discovered by the retesting before it went into space. That plus the Lisa, I think her name is Nowak or something like that. Her trial comes up, I believe, in September, and she had, mace, gun, knives, and ropes and things like this, and she was about to do something to her romantic rival lady in Florida. Doesn't sound to me like she was going to sit down and have a nice conversation with her. Her intentions don't look honorable. So all three of these stories are coming up this week, and NASA is having a pretty tough time. They're going to live through it, but what's your take on all this? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, pretty strong allegations there came out. Without specifics, that's terrible. You know, you can't make a blatant statement like that about any organization and then not be specific. And then it becomes newsworthy. Wow, that's no good. Whoever came out with that, they need to be investigated on how they make a report. That's what I think. But you take the astronaut 14 days confinement before they take off. You know, that, for a number of reasons too. Sometimes they're night flights. You want the crew to be bright eyed, bushy tail when they take off. You know, they'll go into a building and the lighting is lit during the night, and they get used to the daylight being nighttime and reverse. It's the circadian effect. You know, the ability to stay awake at night. Very important. I remember every one of those Hubble space stations, Hubble repair missions, especially those, they would take off at night, what, four or five of them when they service that, plus quite a few other missions that have done that. So 2 weeks you'll spend inside of a building and together studying, practicing, getting ready for your experiments if you're a mission specialist, getting ready for training for using robotic arms and all these things. These are two work weeks before you take off. So the allegations sound pretty bizarre to me, Dick. And of course, the other reason they do that is they try to eliminate the possibility of getting a cold or, you know, picking up the flu from some worker taking it up and out of space, you know. So that's a number of reasons they do that. So one case they said, oh yeah, maybe the guy going up in the Soyuz spacecraft when they take off from Russia and go to the International Space Station, I think that's been done a half a dozen times or so. I mean, what are they out drinking vodka in the middle of the field and putting them on a spacecraft? I don't think so. We'll wait for further allegations before I make any further comments. It doesn't sound right to me. Lisa Norwalk situation, well, it's already old news. They've got good lawyers, and they're going to work through that. I think they've already discounted a lot of some of the bizarre allegations that they've already come up with. I'm sure there's problems. And they work through it. Like any organization or any group, there's going to be problems in it. Not one group is completely immune. Look at the early astronauts, you know. They were having one good old grand time, you know. And, they were having parties. They all kept it quiet in the news media. Everybody was giving Corvettes. That was standard procedure. and there was a lot of plotting going on. Well, John Glenn, of course, he was a Boy Scout. He didn't go that route. And when they got up to the second group of astronauts, when they started getting away from, you know, strictly pilots, and they started to think more engineers, that type of group was more important, scientific-minded. Buzz Aldrin being really the first main one, I think. He was terrific with all his physics and everything. He was outstanding, and things really changed even back then. So they have it, Dick. I'll give you a regular space report, but we do have Endeavour coming up, a pretty interesting flight on the 7th. Back to you, Dick.
Let's have the good news, Paul.
Oh, yeah. I'm more of the good news. Now, this is ham radio, and I am one-sided, so, you know, I no question I have bias toward NASA. Dick, Endeavour is going up on the 7th of August, STS-118. And this thing is going to bring up another truss section, just like you said, the truss assembly. They want to know if it gets hit with micrometeorites and things like that. And that big truss section is like going to be 300 feet long when it's finished. And it's almost getting there now. And that's what you were talking about before, the guy who supposedly cut his wires. And they're going to monitor the outside of the truss assembly. That's another report I'll have to see. That sounds kind of bizarre, too, by the way. But this is another section. They call it there's 11 sections, and this is one other section, like a spacer between the two solar panels on the starboard side. So they call it the S5 section. It's like a 3,000 or plus piece of equipment. It's all aluminum. When you look at it, you say, how could it weigh 3,000 pounds? Got equipment inside. It is a heavy unit, and they're going to install that spacer. They'll be using three spacewalks to do this, to install what they call it, the S5 truss segment. And actually, the first spacewalk will be done after the robotic arm takes it out of the space shuttle and attaches it to the S4. Truss that's already up there. There's a total of six on each side, and then there's a center one, so there's 11 pieces to this whole thing. And after it's attached, you have to do a space walk and bolt it up, and disconnect all a lot of shipping hardware that has to be disconnected when attached to the space shuttle, you know, to prevent vibration. They're always taking these parts of on the spacewalk to get this thing ready. Plenty of different connections to connect and disconnect every time they hook up another segment. Now this thing is big. It's like 14 by 14. And then, you know, feet long and wide, and then, of course, you know, maybe another 8 feet deep. That's the size of this thing. Eventually, connected to it will be another solar array brought up on another mission. And the three spacewalks, the first spacewalk, they'll be connecting everything up. And then on the second spacewalk, you'll have the same two guys that did the first spacewalk will go out there. They're going to hook up power cables and something called the External Storage Platform. They call it the ESP. Platform that contains this refrigerator-sized gyro. One of the projects on the mission is on EBA-2 is to change out a failed gyro. Well, the old gyro has been shut down, and that's going to be stored on
what they call ESP2, these ESP units, like big platforms that are attached to the truss segment, and they'll store things there that they need or don't need, and they'll leave the valve gyro on ESP2, and then on ESP3 that they're bringing up with them and reattaching to the end of the truss arm, they're going to temporarily store the gyro there and then eventually put it where it belongs. Then there'll be a third spacewalk. This is the first time I've noticed this. Well, I haven't seen this on the internet or anything. We're going to have, like, Clayton Anderson, who is part of the Expedition 15 crew, one of the now permanent three members on the International Space Station, do a spacewalk with Mastriano. This guy is, he's the main guy for the space shuttle. He's doing all the spacewalks. He's going to do a spacewalk with Clayton from the Expedition 15 crew. But the idea of that is to go out and prepare for the relocation of the P6 structure, the truss structure. That's the one that's coming out vertically out of the space station. It's been there forever, for years. Temporarily stored at P6, meaning the port side, 6 meaning the 6th location for the truss assembly. See, that eventually has to be completely disconnected on a future flight and moved with the robotic arm and the mobile transport unit. That's like a little train, and that's going to, that'll ride down the whole length of the truss and then reattach that to the end, and that'll be the completion of the port side. So eventually you'll have 4 gigantic solar array, these things like 240 feet long each, 40 feet wide each one, and there'll be 4 of them to power the whole space station. On the Endeavour, they did a lot of upgrades to the unit. It hasn't flown like, I don't know, 4 years or so, and safety upgrades, similar to what they did on Discovery and Atlantis. And all the shuttles eventually, get upgraded, and the final one for the Endeavour. One of the things that they put on, I thought was pretty interesting, is something called the SSPTS. They call it SPIT, but it's called the Station to Shuttle Power Transfer System. What this is a way to electrically connect to the International Space Station. Because now that they have so many solar panels up there, there's plenty of power, so they'll be able to have extended missions. Let me drop it a second. They're going to have extended missions. For instance, it's an 11-day mission plan. But if this SPIT unit, they call it, works, the first time they're using it, they'll be able to spend an extra 3 days up on the attached to the International Space Station, if they like. And if they do, they're going to actually plan a 4th EVA, because they'll have more time to do what they want to do. And they want to get ahead work, for something called an inspection boom. They're going to have an inspection boom permanently attached to the space station. So anytime the space station, space vehicle goes up there, either now or in a future with your Orion missions, you'll be able to, if you take this permanently mounted little boom, and it'll be able to look around the space shuttle instead of doing all these pirouettes that they do now, and they photograph it at all. That'll cut back on all of that. And so they want to do some get ahead head work, and that'll be on EVA 4 if this station, this shuttle power transfer system works. And eventually, with the other solar panels up there, future space shuttles that go up will be able to extend. Except like 3 days, they'll be able to stay for like 6 extra days for an 11-day mission. It'll be no problem going up, for 17, 18 days attached to the space station. Do a lot more work. It takes a lot of time to even transfer all these supplies. In the back of the space station, they have in the back of the space shuttle, they have a space pad, 5,000 pounds of water, food, clothes, God knows what else. All have to be transferred to the International Space Station and saw something. You know, I mean, this thing is, I don't know how many gigantic cubic feet there are. It's like four or five rooms of, to put all this stuff in. So it has to go somewhere. It's not like you push through the round 1 meter hash and that's the end of it. You know, it has to go somewhere. It neatly goes somewhere. And the other things have to leave and come back. So like 5,000 pounds of stuff coming out, 5,000 pounds are going to be coming back. They don't do it. And they'll bring back and land on, you know, with the shuttle, get rid of it. So that's pretty much it for that. And another thing, I mentioned the Orion mission. You know, they call it the Ares / Orion mission. Ares rockets are going to be used. And the Orion spacecraft, the future missions that will not only go to the International Space Station, but eventually onto the Moon and onto Mars, have landed and all to go to the Moon. Well, this project is starting to develop this. They want to work eventually, get some hardware together. But you can see they're committed already. They just gave a contract out to a Florida company. I don't know what the name was. I don't remember what it was. I don't know on the internet, but some company down in Florida that's going to put up towers around 39A, where they're going to launch these things from in the future. And they're going to put these 600-foot towers. I mean, that's big. There's three of them. Three of these 60-story towers surrounding the pad, and some kind of cables and wires connected between them. For lightning protection, this is a $27 million contract just for lightning protection. Can you imagine that? And but here's the tower, you know, 600 feet tall, freestanding, no guy wires. These things have to be able to stand by themselves. There, so I'd like to have that contract, $27 million. That's just, you know, we need some lightning protection here. You know what the cost of all these future programs are going to be. That's pretty much it. That's been out there. I don't want to talk about Mars, unless you want to, with the Spirit and Opportunity. They have some problems with all the dust. Why did you really get low and kind of following that? You know, sometimes they have like 3 days off. They shut the thing down and instead of using them every day now because they're running out of power. But I think that's pretty much it for now. Back to you, Kate, to RIWW.
Give me a couple more words on these 600-foot towers. Is there a pair of them? Are they going to be adjacent to launch pads 39A and 39B, lightning arresting towers? Give me a few more words on this one. And how many million-dollar contract was that, Paul? Fascinating story.
Yeah, I wish I was a billion-dollar ham. You know, hired this contractor, listen, I need a 600-foot tower up here in Long Island to put my beam on. I like that. Freestanding, three of them. So I guess they're going to be 120 degrees set around the 39A or B, whatever. I forget if it's A or B, the two launch pads at 39. They're using one of them now for the space shuttle. Whatever the other one that they took apart a couple months ago, they're going to build up. Three individual 600-foot towers. And I guess some kind of lightning cables or something connected between these things. I don't know if they're going to be in here. That's the way they made it seem. You know, I just can't imagine a cable going from one to the other to the other. But maybe electrically on the ground, maybe they're going to connect them. I don't know what they mean by cables connected. But, that's what it is. Three independent 600-foot freestanding towers at $27 million. Sounds like a lot of money. Thank you.
No, that's the right amount of money. And my guess is the three towers are going to be in a triangular pattern around launch pad 39A and 39B. And somewhere near the tops of those towers will be cables between them, making a Faraday shield, a wire cage, so to speak. Three support structures and a upper triangle, and you could say a lower triangle is the Earth, and anything inside of that is extremely unlikely to be struck by lightning or even seeing a significant